One other quick question that we had was something that we had sent you before, one of the questions that we had sent you before, and it related to a presentation that Dr. Nevins had provided to this committee in our March meeting. And specifically, it was, in fact, there were two inaccuracies in what we wrote. We referred to it as relating to the Bonifoy study, and referred to 99 and 44. I think it was 99 non-responders and 34 responders had been characterized in this particular data set using a signature score that was applied to microarray data on 133 breast cancer patients. There was then a discovery that there was a miscoding of 12 in each group, 12 responders miscoded and 12 non-responders miscoded. And when the corrections were made, the nice predictiveness of this very important validation trial disappeared. Our concern was, in part, that this error had occurred, but also that if this had been in a pseudo-random way, it would have seemed as though it was unlikely that it would have accounted for a complete disappearance. So the question that we had for you was, are there any other data sets that you found in your extensive exploration that were flawed, that in fact showed the same kind of systematic difference that would not be explainable just by a pseudo-random process?
Well, let me give you some data, and then Bill, if needed, can fill in some detail about what was behind this. When I initially was called in to help out in a significant way in the project, the first question I had was, given what you told me, what about all the manuscripts that Dr. Potty was a co-author on? A search of the internet came up with about 100 manuscripts. Majority of those were reviews or opinion pieces or manuscripts that were written while he was at other institutions. There were about 40 that had original data that were generated at Duke, included in the manuscripts. And that was just an estimate as best I could tell by reading the manuscripts. So I think you've seen this, but we constructed a letter that went to all the co-authors of those 40 manuscripts. There were a total of around 162 co-authors, and the letter had three parts. The first was just announcing that we had an institutional need to understand the veracity of the manuscripts that had the institution's name on it. Second was just the statement of ICMJE criteria for authorship. And the third was an attestation form that asked, do you stand behind the work? And it was a learning exercise for me, having been a journal editor for a long time, to actually go back and reread the criteria for authorship. To be clear, all the authors don't have to be able to stand behind all the work. They have to be able to stand behind the work that they took accountability for. And they're supposed to understand who was accountable for the other elements of the manuscript. And then those people need to stand behind it. So there's really a team element to this. The end result, and we're, the goal line is in sight. We're almost there. About a third of the manuscripts are being fully retracted. About a third are having a portion retracted with other components of the manuscript intact, and about a third seem to be okay. And in those retractions and partial retractions is a clear correlation between the need to withdraw the data and the extent to which the data originated from Dr. Potty. So to be specific about that, in the partial retractions, he had a manuscript that involved collaborators from around the world on a topic, and there were two tables and five figures. There will be specific tables and figures that co-authors are retracting. Now, this is work in progress. As you know, once you've started a retraction process, it actually takes a lot of back and forth with the journal to figure out exactly how to handle it. We, as an institution, are now communicating with a number of the journals about this. In several cases, Bill has actually kindly gone back and helped the co-authors, and if I could have one more minute, what I've learned about co-authors, and I think this is really important for what you all have to say. I found, and you might ask the question, how could we have 40 manuscripts with 162 co-authors where two-thirds need to have some element retracted, and there was a public controversy, all the publicity, and yet no one essentially did anything significant until the institution wrote a letter and asked the question. And the answer is complicated, but it partly has to do with the sort of parsing that you've heard about. Of people didn't really work as a team. They didn't know what all the other team members were. There's also an element of junior people being lead authors, not necessarily understanding all of the work. There's some gratuitous co-authorship involved here. But fundamentally, at the basis of it is a lot of people having their names on papers without really having fulfilled the criteria for authorship. And then I think a great hope when something like this happens that somehow it'll all go away because you didn't really do anything wrong yourself and not feeling the need to proactively do something. But we really need a and these are 162 co-authors, about half of whom are no longer at Duke. They're spread around the world. So I don't think this is a Duke-specific problem. I think it's something that really needs a lot of emphasis.
So this oversight and this overview of 40 articles, in essence, if I'm following what you're saying, about a dozen of them had sufficiently significant irregularities that retractions are being made. Another dozen have partial retractions. And in a number of those instances, are patterns seen similar to what we're seeing in the Nevins data where there, it's difficult to, not only are there QC problems here, but there are concerns that the patterns that you're seeing don't look like the errors are pseudo-random?
It looks like they're fundamentally not reproducible.
One of the articles that, in time is short, we won't really get into it, we sent you some questions about it, was the Sue et al. Article, and there were issues about cell lines 16, 17, 18, and issues about four important genes that NCI couldn't validate, and they happened to be genes that enhanced the biological plausibility. It's those kinds of patterns where the cell lines fall right on the line, or the genes that can't be validated happen to be the ones that are the most adding to the most of the biological plausibility. Those are the kinds of things that I'm calling non-pseudo-random that seem particularly problematic. I assume that's one of the 40 that you reviewed in that process. So my sense is the answer, and I'm impressed with the thoroughness of your oversight going back and looking at all four of these. My sense is that, yes, the Nevins article that the Nevins reported experience that he shared with us on March 30th is not unique. You're identifying this, not in all, but in a number of these other papers.
Your sense of concern is appropriate, but also all this feeds into the research misconduct process that is going to play out and draw the necessary conclusions at the end.
Well, I mean, these retractions are public.
Yeah, I'd like to make as many public comments as I would be allowed, and I do think, in particular, with the charge that I accepted at the NCI to review the David Shi JCO 2007 paper, in which you ask about here, I'd like to make a direct statement about. You know, I did go back and review an attempt to recreate the figures in that paper, I would like to point out, I would like it to be known that. In terms of the question being asked about the provenance of the cell line data, let me slow down here a little bit and be cautious. The genomics data was accessible. The genomics data that, in terms of providing the report to the NCI in April 2009, that was based on a raw form of the genomics information. What was also provided from the letter by Neil Potty in 2010, was a table annotating that for the figure 2 of that JCO paper, there was a set of ovarian cell lines that had known sensitivity And so provided to the NCI was a table listing the cell lines and saying what their sensitivities were in terms of IC50 values. That was what I attempted in the months that followed to try and recreate from that table and from the raw genomics information the actual figure, and was failing to do so, but continuing to try different parameterizations because there were things that were pointed out by Dr. McShane and Dr. Baggerly in terms of understanding that this cisplatin signature, as it had been annotated and implemented in the clinical trial, did not match what appeared in the original JCO paper. So I had there was all sorts of different elements to try in terms of seeing if anything would recreate that figure. So in that process, that was when Anil Patti was put on administrative leave. At the time, I had asked for any other primary sources of data to be provided to me, none of which were by anyone in Anil Patti's lab or Joan Evans' lab. Subsequent to being put on administrative leave, I gained access to archived servers of data and found a data source that was dated in 2006 prior to the submission of the JCO paper. That was the primary, what I could conclude from reviewing the file, appeared to be the primary source for that in vitro experimentation. In beginning to review that file, the first thing that became clear to me was that, in fact, based on the tabulated in vitro data, it was, in fact, not IC50 dose response curves that were done. It was actually a cell survival over time that the original experiments were. So you apply a concentration of the drug and you see what the percent cell death after 15 days was. So that was the first indication, was that there was a misattribution of what the in vitro data involved. But what was also known at that point was the annotation of the cell lines and their IC50 values was a complete mismatch to what was provided to the NCI in April of 2010, and that you line them up and that 10 of 17 of the cell lines had discordant values, despite being a complete, they were discordant, but ordered like one another. So, as observed from what Joan Evans presented before, with the same ramifications that when taking the raw genomic data and the result that was provided to the NCI, you have a very strong positive association, actually negative association, because IC50 being the direction that it is, or cell sensitivity. When you correct or when you apply the original data, that is entirely attenuated and no longer statistically significant. So that is the level of deduction and process.
Okay, that certainly, those are added helpful insights. We also had some questions about the validation of the cisplatin predictor, the four important genes, and access to the referee report. Okay. But in the interest of time, I'm proposing that we move forward. We would like to spend at least a little bit of time in a wrap-up session with you and not hold you much longer. And it would be useful for us to maybe have a five-minute break to do that. So, Gil, was there some final thought you had before moving on?
I do just want to commend you for trying to figure out what the impact is much more broadly. These many articles all had Patti as an author, is that correct? Evans as an author also?
Not all.
Have you, by any chance, launched an inquiry also on other uses of, that's like secondary uses of these classifiers by other people where he is not an author?
I'm not an oncologist nor a basic scientist, so I can't be 100% sure about this, but the vast majority of these articles are, I don't know the right word, sort of passe now in terms of having any practical implication for ongoing science. We're aware of one situation in Florida where one of our junior investigators went to another cancer center and had some grants to do clinical trials based on a predictor, but those predictors were abandoned. Dr. McShane knows a lot about this. I think you've heard about it.
We've made independent inquiries there.
And my understanding is they stop using the predictors fairly early and develop their own. At that point, we don't think we have any purview over what they might do, but we're not aware of any other case where this has led to ongoing human investigation or significant follow-on basic science that's of any importance. It's really, for me, to a large extent, it's been clarifying the record to not have faulty data in the permanent record, and it's been a tremendous learning experience for our junior faculty. Initially devastating, but I think most of them have recovered fully and are a lot stronger now for having thought about the implications of this in the rest of their careers.
Certainly hope so.
Okay.
So we will take no more than a 5-minute break. We'll be back and try to wrap up in the final 20 minutes then.
Okay.